Monday, February 14th, and we're about to begin our Department of Human Services Health Services Division hearings, and we'll begin today with the Health Service Cluster Overview and focus on public health programs. Welcome Assistant Director for Health and Human Services, Barry Cass. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I am Barry Cast. I'm the Assistant Director for Health Services of the Department of Human Services. And I thought we could begin this morning with a little overview. This is a large cluster of important programs serving a lot of the caseload in the Department of Human Services. I thought it would be helpful to begin by talking about the full week and where we're going through Thursday. Today, as you mentioned, I'd like to give a very brief overview of this cluster of programs, explain a little why it was organized in 1971 when the changes occurred in the department, and then take the rest of the morning to focus on our public health services. Public health is a unique area within the department and merits some of its own time, a little explanation about why it is the way it is, and then let you meet each of the office administrators to discuss the programs and the key performance measures that they're responsible for. And then tomorrow we anticipated, if the time works out this way, to spend the whole morning on the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. This is our community mental health programs, our alcohol and drug programs, and large institutions. And then on Wednesday, Barney Spade and Lynn Reed would be here to talk about medical assistance programs. And in reflecting on last week's testimony, we've set aside the entire day on the 17th to take a look at the priorities in health services and the list of reductions that accompanied our presentation document. And a number of us would be here to walk through those with you and discuss the meaning of them. And if that sounds like an acceptable way to proceed, that's where we would...
Sounds good. Go. Thank you.
Now, I understand that things always take on a life of their own, and I know there will be questions, and but that's the guiding logic. As you can see from this discussion so far, the health cluster really is composed of three major sections: public health, mental health and addictions, and medical assistance programs. It's my hope that rather than presenting the entire cluster all at once over and over again, that each of the section leaders would review briefly the services they provide and discuss their key performance measures and additional outcomes to which they manage in their sections. And perhaps it's best, though, now that I introduce you to them, because they're all here in the back of the room. People rarely sit in the front row, it seems. But let me introduce to you Barney Spate from the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, and he'll be joined by his deputy, Lynn Reed, when the... Is Lynn here today? No. On Wednesday. Bob Nickel is the administrator of our Office of Mental Health and Addictions Programs, an area getting considerable attention during this legislative session. Grant Higginson is our state public health officer. James Mason runs the Office of Multicultural Health, an organization within the department that was organized in 1994. Mel Cohn is here. He's the state epidemiologist and runs a cluster of programs that are focused on acute and communicable disease, disease prevention, and health promotion. Mike Skeels, a former administrator of the of public health in Oregon some years ago, is now the head of our public health laboratory and is sitting in the back of the room. And finally, Lorraine Duncan is here. Lorraine, briefly last fall, was the acting head of our Office of Family Health, and the new director of that office was not able to be with us this week. She just joined the department in December and had prior obligations, so we'll be introducing her to you in the next phase of these discussions. And I must say, just from my own perspective, that this is the A-team. These are very high-quality, well-trained people who've done a really outstanding job for the state, and you'll have a chance to hear directly from them how they do that. I wanted to begin, though, by putting the health cluster in context. About 10 days ago, when Gary Weeks and Cindy Becker were here, they walked you through the whole department. The first... Any idea why it isn't moving?
You don't have a mouse, do you? Let's see.
Well?
Slideshow.
Okay.
Let's do enter. Oops.
View.
And view show. Okay. And then, there we go.
Okay. Ready? This first slide shows you the distribution within the department of all of the clusters and programs. Last week you discussed children, adults, and families. This large piece of the pie, constituting almost half the total program for the Department of Human Services, is the health services cluster. The yellow tab, health services, contains a very brief discussion of the cluster. It appears at the beginning of that section before any of the other sub-tabs, and I'll be referencing that. But primarily, what I wanted you to take away from this portion of the discussion is just a general bird's eye view of how this cluster is organized. Within the cluster, as I mentioned, there are three basic program areas: public health services, mental health and addiction services, and medical assistance programs. Public health services constitute about 8%, actually 7.6% of this budget, total funds. Mental health and addiction is about 12%, and the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, including the Oregon Health Plan, is about 80% of the total funds expended. If you look at the funds expended in this cluster by type, you can see that about 57% are federal funds, 18% other funds, largely fee and other kinds of grant revenues and certain kinds of specialized taxes, a very small amount of lottery funds, and about a quarter of the revenue is general funds. And then finally, here's how we spend these dollars. Services and supplies and personal services together constitute less than 10% of the cluster's budget. Most of the dollars that we spend in this cluster are going out the door to support local entities, county government, private agencies, healthcare providers, health plans that do these services at the local level. And in a very important way, these services really are very locally directed and differ substantially from the way in which some of the rest of the department has a field operation. The field is the provider system that's out there, and we fund them and pay them.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Montes Anderson.
Back to the previous slide. With the 57% being federal funds, do you know how much of that is match, or is it all match, or is there some that there's no match regarding federal funds?
Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, it is not all matching funds. We do have some block grant revenue that comes from the federal government for specific purposes, such as the mental health block grant, which is not a matching program, or the preventive health and health services block grant in public health is not a matching program.
Is that a follow-up?
Is
the majority, the greater percentage, with match money, or do you know that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the greater percentage
is
matching revenue. And we can certainly break that out for you.
No, I don't need
that. I'd like to see it. The only exceptions to the local provision of services are really two, and those are the state-operated state hospital programs and the laboratory and certain licensing functions in public health that we perform because they are so specialized and because they can't be distributed around the state like other services can. This has implications for how we operate in this cluster, because most of what we are doing is coordinating policy, seeking resources, managing contracts, payments, large volumes of data, and assuring the accountability and quality of services provided by others. I wanted to especially call to your attention the role of county government. They have been our partners in many of these services for many, many years. They are the local mental health authorities. They are also the local public health authorities. And in the past, in these hearings, they have joined us in making this presentation to demonstrate this relationship that is a unique one in state government. Finally, I want you to know that we have in this branch of the department about 2,100 employees, positions. That's about one-fifth of all of the Department of Human Services. And the majority of those workers are in the state hospital. So in summary, The health cluster is about half the department's budget, about 20% of its staff, and 90% of its funds are invested in local services under contract, and they go out the door. The mission of the cluster is to improve the health of all Oregonians, and we do that in several ways. First, we promote healthy communities and individual behaviors. We prevent unnecessary death and disability. We support the best possible treatment for mental health and addictions and other tobacco and other drug dependency. And a major goal is to ensure access to adequate health care for those who can't otherwise obtain it. Health Services supports every part of the department's mission. Obviously, healthy Oregonians are the centerpiece of our mission, but safety and independence also depend on having a functional health delivery system and preventive health system. So, for example, we are very involved with child welfare and assuring that when a family has an alcohol and drug problem, there's a resource there that can provide support and treatment for that family. And similarly, in getting people back to work who are engaged in the self-sufficiency programs, mental health treatment for people with depression is certainly removes a major obstacle. So, lest there be any misunderstanding, this department really is an integrated effort. We separate things out for the purpose of managing them and administering them, but we work together very closely to make sure that each program area supports the others where appropriate. Therefore, I think you'll find as the week goes on, that the health cluster is involved in virtually every key performance measure. We're directly responsible for 16 of the 28 key performance measures. These are listed and we'll be referring later on in the appendix to the overall department presentation. It's the large 75 or 80 page report on benchmarks and performance measures that you were talking about last week. But in addition to the 16 that the cluster is directly responsible for, we participate in delivering the kinds of services that help other clusters achieve their goals. And it's not only limited to programs within the department, because we're engaged, for example, in developing policies and programs around early childhood, which I know you've taken an interest in when the commission was here before you. And we work together with the commission, with the Department of Education, with other the Youth Authority and other entities to craft a policy on early childhood which makes sense and avoids duplication. And similarly, we're working with law enforcement. We are participating in rural health policy and rural policy generally, and our emergency response, which you'll hear about from Dr. Higginson a little later on, is integrated with the newly formed Office of Homeland Security and soon to be a department. I hope that the discussion over the next few days will demonstrate this interconnectedness of goals and services within the department, as this was one of the fundamental rationales for reorganizing the department several years ago in the first place.
Mr. Cass, can you maybe answer something? You understand that I'm pretty inexperienced at this. One thing that is hard for me to determine is whether or not all that we're doing is really making much of a difference. There, you know, I had an opportunity to visit the capitals, I think you've heard of these other, of Idaho, Utah, Nevada, and California, and one of the questions I talked to them about was the delivery of human services and how their state does it compared to Oregon, and found that there was quite a different approach to it. Idaho said, well, we don't really do nearly what Oregon does. We're more just focused on what Medicaid requires, and we're not known as being very generous. Utah said, you know, Oregon's leading out in a lot of different ways. Nevada said Oregon's leading out in a lot of different ways. And California was just chaos. I mean, there it was enjoyable to go to the floor and watch a small country. I mean, it's, you know, their assembly is like a small country, and listen to them argue over a tax in the increase in the middle of a $30 billion flood of red ink. It was like, you know, it was a unique experience, but it wasn't real helpful in trying to get a benchmark. And so can you help us understand how do we determine whether or not the money being spent in Oregon is really making much of a difference if other states are not doing it the way that Oregon is, And I'm not hearing that other states are flooding to the Oregon model, then, you know, is Oregon really doing it the right way? Or is there things that we, when you compare us with other states, are we just continuing to do what we have been doing? Is there any way that we can actually compare whether or not the choice that we're making is worthwhile and proper use of the extent of funds and resources that we have?
Mr. Chairman, I have been doing this work for about 30 years, and when you've seen one state, you've really seen one. States have the, under the Constitution, the option to do things differently, and each state does, and some states become models in one area and another. Over the years that I've been working for state government, we've had people coming to Oregon to find out how we do things, and sometimes we go elsewhere for different kinds of programs. So the real test is the data and whether we're achieving the goals that you've set for us. And I think you'll see that we measure everything we do, and in some areas where we succeed, we've exceeded in a way that has caught the attention of the rest of the nation. But where we don't succeed, we look for ways to improve by talking with other states. And I've asked each of the administrators, as they come before you, to be prepared to talk about how Oregon relates to other states' performance in programs, for example, such as communicable disease or food safety or mental health, so that you can get some sense of the relative achievement that's happening here. But part of the dilemma, of course, is that much of the way in which the relationship we've had with the federal government has been run for a number of years is through demonstrations and waivers that are designed to test new methods of doing business. So, for example, in the mid-90s, with the advent of so-called welfare reform, Oregon had a dramatic improvement in its system and became a model for other parts of the country. We had very steep drops in caseloads, changes in the way work was done. We were in partnership with the private sector. Other states have had different kinds of performance, and I think you just have to go program by program to answer your question. Well, I will say this. My aged parents live in Central California, and they seem as bewildered as I've seen them in my lifetime over what's happening in that state. I think there's just a lot of distress there, and as a state which was once a model for the country has descended into something of a transition which isn't complete.
Well, a model is determined by not only the appearance but the long-term results. And sometimes what appears to be a model, because it is so pervasive, ends up almost bankrupting the organization because they couldn't sustain it, which also is a concern that we in the legislature have with the average increases in health care of, 12 to 15% a year. The inflation that we've had over the last 10 years of being under 2%, the lack of increased revenue that can compete with the soaring cost. One thing that we'd like to have addressed is, and I don't know if this is a policy issue or maybe you're just implementing the policy, but it looks to me like what we're doing is not sustainable if we continue the draft of the cost, the graph showing every 2 years what the costs were before and what they are, over the last 10 years and what they're projected to be over the future, and you do that with the graph for revenues, it is worrisome to the committee that it may not be sustainable. And so I don't know who really will be answering that and whether or not you can be of some benefit to show us how what is being done at as an efficient level as possible, and will it be sustainable over time?
Mr. Chair, we'll try to do that. One of the goals that this governor put forward in this budget was sustainability, and we've tried to meet that expectation on his part.
Great.
Well, that's the cluster. This cluster was formed in 2001 when the department was reorganized. The previous divisions were abolished, and the principle of organization really was quite different than it had been previously. The change brought under joint management all of the previous health-related services, and I think you'll see that there's really a very broad array of different kinds of health-related services, everything from paying for what is in tantamount to health insurance, sponsoring people for health care in the private marketplace, all the way to providing certain kinds of care that are unavailable in any other way. To organize this cluster, we began by reviewing the kinds of functions that the cluster performed, its services, and in the end, we developed 9 separate offices and a very lean central administration. So most of the action is in the service area. It's with these administrators. Last year, we determined, in consultation with the Conference of Local Health Officials, with members of the Legislative Assembly, that public health is an area deserving some special attention. And that's why you will see during the hearings over the next several weeks, we'll be joined by Dr. Susan Allen, who is going to be the Director of Public Health for the state and will assume responsibility for the 5 public health offices. And she will start in mid-March, and I expect to introduce her to you when she gets here. Currently, she's working in Arlington, Virginia, a place which has had its share of emergency. The Pentagon is located there. The anthrax attacks happened there. They had a hurricane. They had snipers. She's been exposed to a lot of
I can see why
a lot of stress, I think. So she will be here in mid-March, and I look forward to her arriving. So I think that, unless there are questions, that about covers the kind of the general overview. We really focus on the service areas themselves, so I'd like to begin now with public health. I spent most of my career as a mental health administrator, first at the county and then joining the state in the mid-80s. When I was handed this assignment in 2001, I was new to public health, and I have to say I discovered very quickly how little I understood and appreciated about public health, how it operates, how it's organized. And during the last session, we had an extensive discussion about the need to revisit public health and articulate what we do in a better way so that people could understand it. Maybe one way that I can, from a personal point of view, I can tell you that public health touches everyone's life, but in particular mine. Having grown up in Fresno, California, I mentioned my family still lives down there. I remember as a fairly young child, there were periods when we couldn't swim in the public pools because of polio outbreaks that were occurring in the community. And there were always children in our school that had leg braces and so forth. But Fresno has one of the best county fairs in the country. It is a cornucopia of agriculture. And I always liked the building with all the technology in it. And there was always a section where they were demonstrating iron lungs. None of those, you don't see that anymore. That's gone. The advent of the vaccine in the mid-50s changed everything. And this is I don't raise this arbitrarily. I think it's an excellent example because my children have no memory of this stuff. I'm trying to educate them about it. But it illustrates the point that when public health works well, it's something that you don't see. That doesn't make it any less of a good investment, but it's something that you don't see. We do our jobs well, people don't get sick. That's a very different phenomenon from paying bills for people who are gravely ill and who are the object of our compassion. Public health was defined some years ago by the Institute of Medicine. There's been a lot of concern about public health in this country. There have been several reviews. 1988 was a very substantial review. And in seeking a definition, the Institute of Medicine said this, and you can find it on page 3 of the first tab under public health. So if you go to the blue tab that says public health overview and priorities and turn to the first white tab, that's the section we're working from in this segment. And at the bottom of that, page 1, is the IOM definition. IOM is the Institute of Medicine. And they said that public health is what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions for people to be healthy. What we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions for people to be healthy. I find this a deceptively simple statement. And in teasing it apart, I come to 3 basic themes. First is that this is a social good, that it's something we as a community do together. It's not individual practice. It requires collective policymaking and collective activity as a government. Secondly, because we assure, we are protective and preventive. We're not, this isn't a rescuing operation. We're really talking about creating conditions that make people safe. But finally, and perhaps most importantly, this definition does not say that people must be healthy, but only that they have the opportunity to do so because the conditions in which they live allow that. So it leads me to the recognition that good health depends upon not just care, which is very important, but also upon an environment in which hazards are kept to a minimum and in which people can make good choices. And so when you're listening to the administrators talking, you will hear that much of public health is about educating individuals and promoting responsibility and responsible behavior. That's a tough, tough challenge. It means we get into things like nutrition and tobacco and the safety of food, and making good decisions about those things is what keeps us from getting sick. Our mission for the public health programs in the state gives substance to this definition. And that mission is listed also on that page. It's to protect, preserve, and promote the health of all the people of Oregon, to prevent unnecessary death and disability, to improve health status, and reduce the per capita cost of illness care for all. And we have produced and I don't have it today, but I will see that you get it, an illustration of the pervasive influence of public health in the lives of Oregonians, a day in the life of the average person. And if you think about getting up in the morning and turning on the tap and getting safe water with which to brush your teeth and cook your food, if you have lunch in a restaurant, you have some confidence that the food there is safe and not contaminated. You wear your seatbelt. If you have a child, you've got a car seat. All of these are public health components in addition to things like immunizations and response to infections and so forth. We've published this to illustrate, I think, how public health operates in a very broad way to protect and to assure the opportunity for people to be healthy. We've organized the department to accomplish this by establishing 5 public health offices, and we'll describe each of them in some detail for you. These offices are there because we have to have a structure in which to administer different services. The investments you make in these services, you have a right to accountability. But that's what the offices do. They're organized as an administrative entity. But in fact, we have more than 125 separate services that are delivered in public health. It's like, to understand public health, you have to think of it like a mosaic. Each of the tiles contributes to the whole picture. But if you just look at one of them, you can't get the whole picture. We have 73 grants. 66 of them are federal grants. Contrary to popular view, we don't apply for every federal grant opportunity that comes along. We have a plan. It's a plan that you endorse when you adopt our budget, and we pursue those opportunities according to what you are directing us to do through policy. In addition to grant-funded programs, a lot of public health is fee-supported. When a restaurant is licensed, the restaurant is paying the fee for that, and I know that Senator Winters has a lot of experience with that as a former restaurateur. We have 51 separate fee streams, everything from getting your birth certificate to licensing a restaurant, checking in a machine, an X-ray machine. There's dozens of them. And let me give you a bird's-eye view of the public health budget in the same way that we've been talking about the department and the cluster. This exhibit, which is, I think it's number 6 in your package, which each of you should have, shows the public health budget by source of funds. General funds make up about 7% of the budget for public health. And federal funds, of course, are the lion's share. I wanted to point out that there is an error on this slide, and I hope you can correct it on your printed version. because federal funds actually comprise 74% of the budget, and other funds, that's fees, certain grants, et cetera, comprise 18%. Where do we invest these funds? The lion's share are in the Office of Family Health. This program delivers maternal and child health programs, oral health, the very large WIC program, Women, Infants, and Children program, which combines casework with food distribution to assure that families have a healthy start for babies. Public health systems, that's the branch of our public health offices which does a good deal of environmental health work, toxicology, but it also does most of the licensing in public health. The public health laboratory is about 5%. The public health laboratory tests hundreds of thousands of samples each year, but it also licenses laboratories and environmental laboratories for the state. Disease prevention and epidemiology, about 18.5%. These are the folks that keep an eye on disease outbreaks. They do health promotion. In that office is the Office of Vital Records. If you need a birth certificate, a death certificate, or want to know something about the data about what Oregonians are named, comes out of that office as well. We have a very small Office of Multicultural Health to promote culturally competent service delivery and also to focus on health disparities because there are differences. You'll hear from Mr. Mason, who runs that office, in just a few moments. And finally, the state health officer, Dr. Higginson's office, is about 11%, and that includes some substantial resources from the federal government for public health preparedness. After the 9/11 attacks, that budget really was expanded to prepare for bioterrorism and other hazards that may be a part of this conflict that we're engaged in. Let me point out finally that if you look over the last 10 years, and this is chart number 8, you can see the dramatic expansion of federal fund revenue in the public health budget. But what I would draw your attention to is the general fund portion, which has been fairly flat, if not in small decline in real dollars, for at least a decade. And we'll come back to that later because since we're very dependent on federal funds, federal policy increasingly drives our decision-making processes. And this is a state program, and it is what we as citizens are doing for ourselves, but clearly the shaping influence over the years has really been shifted closer and closer to Washington. The other implication of that, of course, is that the changes in the federal budget are likely to hit hard in this program area, and we're still in the process of assessing what is proposed in the federal budget. Before we turn to service and performance measures, which we'll get to shortly, I wanted to talk a little bit about some background issues. Pages 2 and 3 of this portion of the document give you a little historical perspective for your reference, but I'm not going to go through that. But I will say that the key, that we're about 100 years old, public health in Oregon, and the key effect over the last 100 years in Oregon, as in the rest of the country, has been a dramatic improvement in the quality of life and the extension of life expectancy of more than 30 years. This is due mostly to better systems, safer water, for example, sanitary systems, broad-scale immunization, and improved safety and efficacy of health care itself, and also increased access to care. I wanted to talk for a moment about this relationship between these systems and the issue of treatment. And I want to point out that about 97% of the money we spend in the health cluster is spent providing direct medical care. This chart, which we refer to as the public health pyramid or the health pyramid, illustrates that there is a relationship between the foundation of a healthy society, which is social, economic, and environmental conditions in which people can be healthy, the middle tier, which is the organization of community prevention activities, whether it's prevention around drug abuse or its prevention around diseases that are preventable. They occupy a kind of middle ground between the basis of health in broadly and our efforts to shore up our health, the health of the public. And then at the top of the pyramid is direct care. As you go up this pyramid, the cost increases. Direct care is much more expensive than prevention by a factor logarithmic factor. The treatment of illness is more expensive than preventing illness, and so investments made in the bottom of this pyramid, if we're right about this, should prevent costs in the top of the pyramid. And a lot of what you'll hear is about preventing disease and avoiding cost, preventing the inevitable cost that comes if you don't immunize people, if you don't make sure that they are aware of the healthy and responsible behaviors that will keep them from getting sick. In Oregon, we spend...
Question for you. Yes, sir. Is there any consequence to that portion of the population that through their choices have dramatically higher requirements for health care services that are paid for by a population that do not participate in those lifestyle choices?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I really understand your question.
The focus needs to be on prevention because it's much cheaper to prevent than to treat. And what I'm asking is there any consequence to those that pay no attention to that and to that live in lifestyle choices, whether it be tobacco, alcohol, drugs, or any number of things that have a dramatic increase in cost to the public to provide the treatment for them? Is there any consequence to those folks, or do they just get unlimited benefits because it's just the way it is?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there are dramatic consequences, sometimes up to and including death. But they're not consequences that are limited only to the individual. They are consequences that fall back to us. So, for example, untreated tuberculosis cannot be permitted because it will come back to affect the rest of us.
Well, we're not talking about untreated tuberculosis.
We're talking about...
such a rare situation. Of course public safety has to deal with a communicable disease like that. I'm talking about other things that I'm just wondering if in our process in providing treatment, and again, you're educating us, if there's any consequence for people who make choices in lifestyles that require tremendous amounts of resources. For instance, a person that has been an alcoholic all their life and they have renal failure and they're 75 years old and it's going to cost $150,000 to give a transplant or something like that. Well, those are funds that could have been utilized for 100,000 people in a treatment program or in a prevention program, but are being focused on an extension of life or without much quality of life, maybe. And I'm just wondering, is there any consequence to people who make those choices, or does the public just pay for whatever it has to pay?
Mr. Chairman, if the consequences you're talking about are, for example, the denial of care, that is a policy question that is, I think, will be very vexing as this healthcare crisis evolves. I mean, we do have to make decisions about where resources will go. But at this point, at least, for example, in the use of tobacco, we can quantify what those costs are. People who use tobacco have a pretty good idea of what the consequences are going to be. But in terms of the steps
of allocation of resources.
Yes, I understand your question, and I think the effort we're making is to allocate a relatively small amount of resources to do everything we can to help people make better decisions about their behavior, so that those consequences won't fall either to them or to us as payers.
Is there much going on in the way of ethical discussions on the choice of allocation of resources that is coming with the aging population?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. And just tell you a story which I told actually at the last session, so I don't want to bore people, but my father had one of these bypass operations at 75, which is rather late in the stage. He's a subscriber to Kaiser. And we were there when he came out of the anesthesia, which took hours and hours and hours. And, you know, the first thing he said to me is, why are they spending all this money on me? And I said, we'll talk about health policy when you get home. You know, but I think there is a recognition that as the population ages and as the technology improves and the cost is quantifiable, that we're going to be faced with very, very difficult choices between, for example, prevention and treatment, or between treatment and education, or between treatment and some other public good that is the subject of those policy discussions. And
I can see
we're here to help you with that, but I can't give you the answer to that.
Well, I can see it as being a very important discussion that is so sensitive that it would be, you know, kind of want it to be avoided because it ultimately is going to require decisions and, you know, broad brush approaches that affect individual lives.
Exactly. And, Mr. Chairman, that was the way in which the health plan was crafted a dozen years ago, was through a discussion with the public about these very questions, about what to do about people who are ill, for whom there is no likely positive outcome to their illness, versus people who are acutely ill and for which treatment is essential and works. And I was not a part of those discussions, but Mr. Spate, who will be here on Wednesday, can describe that decision-making process, which was surrounded by an ethical discussion as well as the community's perception of health and how those decisions ought to influence your decisions as policymakers.
Okay,
so I think that we were constantly performing that calculus, but unlike mathematics in general, there isn't one answer at the end of that process. At some point, there's some very difficult questions that come up. I'm trying to be as evasive as possible in answering.
You're successful.
I wanted to just to finish this point. The per capita expenditures on health services for Oregonians is thousands of dollars per year. The per capita expenditures in the public health budget is about $60 per capita per year. And for that investment, we get pretty good drinking water, we get pretty safe food supply, we have good vaccination programs. It's a real bargain. I hope you'll take a look at it in that perspective. Now, no Oregonian, now this is the question that you just raised, Mr. Chairman, so I'm going to give you a perspective here. But I think that most people in our state would agree that no Oregonian should be denied needed, effective care, whether they're poor or not. But investments in prevention ultimately reduce the need for care. And when successful, these services, as I pointed out earlier, are transparent. So when you turn on the tap and drink a glass of water and don't get sick, it's hard for you to think immediately about public health services in the state of Oregon. It's a part of life. One way that we can demonstrate the value of such services is through communicating the data and trends about illness that indicate that we're achieving progress through the services that you're funding. Data is the key to that. And one critical understanding in public health is that it is driven by mountains of data. Data is the engine that fuels public health. To be effective, public health services need lots of reliable data, trained professionals to understand the data and to analyze it, and a system ready to respond to it. So capacity in public health is a critical concept. A good deal of the time, we are watching. And when a cluster of salmonella cases comes through and you suddenly discover we've got a disease outbreak, then everybody gets into action to address it, contain it, and stop it. And from time to time, you read about these things, whether it's contaminated produce. We had a situation with almonds about 8 months ago. There was an E. coli outbreak at the Lane County Fair a couple of years ago. When you hear about those things, they're extraordinarily dramatic. But to know that those things are happening means that we are vigilant most of the time and watching the data. Now, the fact that we're preventively oriented shouldn't hide the fact that public health has among the highest caseloads in the department. The WIC program, Women, Infants, and Children, this nutrition program for healthier, giving babies a healthier start, serves about 130,000 families. Our family planning waiver is about 100,000 clients, mostly women. And our school-based health center program, which is one of the programs the governor has proposed for further investment, serves about 35,000 clients a biennium, 150,000 visits. Those are substantial numbers, so I guess I'm trying to balance the idea that we're preventively focused, but we also see a lot of individuals in public health caseloads. They differ, however, from general medical care, your health insurance or mine, because we're usually targeting those services on very high-risk populations or on certain kinds of services, such as treatment for tuberculosis or breast and cervical cancer screening, the kind of very specifically targeted services that otherwise people might not have access to.
I've heard that WIC requires that for those women that are receiving the benefits, that they also receive certain training and information, that's part of the requirement for it. Is that, I mean, are you familiar enough with the program to know if that's the case?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm familiar enough to know that that is the case. I don't know, I wouldn't describe it as coercive, but it's a combination of casework and the distribution of food materials. But Lorraine Duncan here from Family Health can answer that question in some detail for you if you'd like.
No, not this moment. What I wanted to bring up is that seems like a fairly reasonable thing to do, to say that if you're going to receive these benefits, we'd like you also to receive some training. I mean, that where the recipient has to give something in return, whether it's their time or even if not attention, but hopefully time and attention. Mm-hmm. And I'm just, as we go along, I'd like to know whether or not there are similar requirements in some of the other programs that will help give information that could be a benefit to changing lives, because it's something that people may not know. You know, it's part of the reason they may be where they're at is because they haven't received training and understanding that people that aren't in those positions may have received. And so I'll just be interested in knowing if there are requirements made of recipients in other programs as well for them to receive training and knowledge that may help them in their lives.
Yes. The answer, Mr. Chair, is resoundingly yes. The purpose of the program is both to provide nutritional products, but also to teach about nutrition, breastfeeding, those kinds of messages, and to do some screening for general health status and make sure that family is getting the right kinds of prenatal care or perinatal care for the newborn infant. So it's an opportunity to help low-income families get the services they need and learn something about how to care for themselves and their families better. So you're absolutely right. I wanted to finish that thought by saying that these direct delivery services are always provided by local professionals, however, not by our own staff. What state staff do for the most part is organize resources and information, analyze data, and provide technical assistance to our local colleagues when they need it. And together, we form a system that pursues a number of preventive strategies. So let me direct you to pages 4 to 7 in this first section. I'm not going to go through them each, but let me just highlight a couple, and then I'd like to get some people up here to talk with you about what they actually do. Acute and communicable disease staff, that's a part of Mel Cohn's office, they're on the lookout for outbreaks and epidemics, and they get some help from the state public health laboratory, which tests hundreds of thousands of samples for both bacterial and viral agents. If there were a bioterror attack in this state, this is how we'd discover it. People would start getting sick, and we would be available to identify what the agent of their illness was and develop a plan for responding. And it's a very critical function of our public health services. We also promote healthy behaviors, and we focus on things like heart disease, stroke, tobacco, better nutrition and exercise to address this growing problem of overweight and obesity. To prevent injuries, we have a whole section that is dedicated to injury prevention, and so on. Over time, as you pointed out, Mr. Chairman, the aging of our society has made it clear that managing chronic illness and preventing chronic illness is becoming a critical factor. So we have programs for diabetes, arthritis, asthma. We screen every newborn in this state, and we also do this for several other states, for 26 major metabolic diseases. And our licensing process also prevents illness because it sets a threshold below which we will not let our water fall, our food decline, radiation that you are exposed to when you go to the dentist's office or go to the hospital. We license hospitals, we license labs. We have a whole section that is dedicated to emergency medical services and organizing a trauma system in the event that happens. And the Patient Safety Commission, which Grant Higginson will talk about, is designed to improve the quality of healthcare delivery in healthcare settings and reduce the chances that healthcare itself will lead to some negative outcome. And finally, and perhaps most abstractly, we do a lot of work to promote access to care through planning and organizing resources, through working with local clinics to get established, find the resources they need, to target their services on low-income populations and the like. We would do a lot to get physicians and nurses to areas of the state that otherwise would not have them, to underserved areas of the state. And as I said before, when grant opportunities arise, we select for your review those that support the adopted approach and goals of the state, and these are often articulated in the benchmarks and in the performance measures that we'll be talking with you about. Now, one important issue is the belief in fairness and equality of access to services that's so important, and that is why disparities in health status among various groups are so troubling to us. So if the prevalence of a disease is different in one population than another, we've got to ask why. And what can we do about it? These disparities often break along racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic lines. Since 1994, the state has had an Office of Multicultural Health to address them. And a governor's task force a few years ago recommended a plan to address racial and ethnic health issues. I want to introduce and ask him to come forward, James Mason. James is the administrator of our Office of Multicultural Health. He's helping us in the cluster generally and particularly in public health to address multicultural health issues, and I've also asked him to update you on the task force recommendations. Now, you may not have a copy of that report, and I'll see that it gets distributed to the committee so that you can take a look at the goals that were set for us in about seven or eight different healthcare areas. This is James Mason. We've been friends a long time.
And we welcome you today.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is James Mason. I'm the administrator for the Office of Multicultural Health. As Mr. Cass suggested, the office is concerned with promoting culturally and linguistically competent services throughout the state for all Oregonians, and also is concerned largely with the issue of health disparities facing certain segments of our population. Referred to a document called the Governor's Racial and Ethnic Task Force Report, which is here, and we'll make sure you get a copy if you don't have one. And there was a group of Oregonians came together in the year 2000 to talk about how health disparities are affecting various populations and what might be done, and issued five major recommendations that I will talk about very briefly and also talk about the department's response. One of the first recommendations was to collect racial and ethnic data in a manner that informs the state's efforts to eliminate health disparities in Oregon. Mr. Cass referred to the importance of data in the work that we do, and it's quite critical. What we found is that collecting data on certain populations is harder than with others. We aren't alone in that problem. Various states are struggling trying to collect accurate, reliable data around groups that are facing health disparities. Washington State followed our pattern, I think, in the report that they did published in the year 2004, which was a supplement to a previous document that was to look at health disparities. However, it failed to include health disparities facing ethnic groups of color, certain social and economic groups, and certain geographic groups as well. So the issue of collecting data is certainly a nationwide issue as well as a regional issue. Minnesota, in trying to collect this data, did two approaches. One was to conduct training, both for professionals collecting the data, but also for the diverse communities for which the data wasn't very comprehensively collected. They also worked with community-based organizations to represent the various groups to assure that the word was getting out and that what the state was doing was was going to be most effective. The department has formed a racial and ethnic data group that advocates for better collection, identifies best practices around collecting health data, performance measures, and general strategies that keeps the state of Oregon informed with respect to elimination of health disparities. The Office of Multicultural Health has recently convened cultural key informant groups to identify ways that we might best educate the community to participate in our data collection efforts and to assure that we have great linkages with those communities, or enhanced linkages with those communities. The second major recommendation was to establish deliverables for eliminating racial and ethnic health disparities. Here they were talking about the importance of addressing access to services, language interpretation, diversity in planning and decision making, diversity in staffing, training, and workforce diversification. Our responses, I think, have been fairly robust. One is that we at the Office of Multicultural Health has worked to establish kind of performance measures that can help us identify areas in which we've grown and areas which we continue to need to grow. Most of the states in the country are still struggling with developing performance measures that work across systems, as we are struggling with that as well in our office, and working closely with other members within health services to assure that the performance measures that are developed make sense and work for them. The department also convenes a Diversity Development Coordinating Council that focuses on workforce diversity, training, and assuring that the environments are hospitable so that the physical plan itself doesn't drive people away or become an impediment to their participation in promoting and seeking better health. The Governor's Office of Affirmative Action also works to diversify the workforce, has identified contractors that can help assess certain systems, also design training that's specific to managing a diverse workforce. And most recently, the Office of Multicultural Health has been involved in promoting an Oregon administrative rule around healthcare interpretation to assure access for all populations within the state of Oregon. The third recommendation was to create a mechanism for attracting and employing a culturally and linguistically competent workforce. This is not an issue that's peculiar to Oregon, the Northwest, but it's an issue facing healthcare institutions throughout the country. For one, there's a dearth of qualified healthcare professionals of diverse backgrounds or experience with working with diverse populations. We work very closely with the schools in the state of Oregon to assure that we are influencing their desire to work in the department, but also making sure that they are paying attention to health disparities as we see it's a growth field in the upcoming years, unfortunately. One of the things that the Office of Multicultural Health absolutely benefits from is my predecessor was an absolute whiz at attracting diverse workers and had a long history working in human resources and the area of recruitment and retention. So the office, as I took the position about 8 or 9 months ago, inherited a bunch of listservs, contacts at graduate professional schools, contacts with community-based organizations to assure that we are getting the word out around our hiring opportunities, also trying to influence the community to promote healthcare careers for diverse citizens in the state of Oregon.
Have you an idea of just roughly percentages of the hiring that comes from within Oregon and those that are imported from other states?
roughly what we're finding is that we are importing more talent than we are creating right now. That will probably occur for some time. The other thing that we're experiencing is that as we create and cultivate talent within the state, often they do their professional education outside the state or seek careers outside of Oregon. So trying to make the environment more conducive to retaining them becomes an issue for us. We also think that as we diversify the workforce, and that diverse workforce is apparent to the general public, that that will create an own momentum of its own to suggest that the department is a good place to work, the department is a good place to pursue a career, the department is a good place for people that care about people. So I would suggest that right now a lot of our talent comes from outside the state.
Is the goal to diversify, or is the goal to help assure that minorities in Oregon have greater opportunities? That's a sincere question. I'm not sure.
It's actually both. One of the things is the literature and theory suggests that diversity in and of itself creates a very powerful tool in providing services. We see this occurring in the private and the public sector, the importance of diversifying. But the other issue itself is that we assure that all Oregonians, including minorities, get adequate health care. So we see them as two separate issues, quite frankly. Diversity in itself being a virtue, but the importance of assuring that all Oregonians have access to health care, irrespective of who they are.
Yeah, I understand the first part. The second part, I was not clear. I'm saying that part of what we're doing with the focus on special care and treatment and resources on minorities is to help Oregonian minorities have greater job opportunities and greater opportunities for education and training and so forth. And part of that's a policy question as to additional scholarships and those kinds of things for healthcare industries for minorities, so that they could be prepared to accept more positions, the delivery of services in Oregon. And I'm just kind of asking whether or not the focus is merely on diversity, or is there enough attention be given on minorities in Oregon to help prepare them to be first choice, hire Oregon minorities first kind of process?
I would say yes. We work closely, as I mentioned, with the graduate schools, trying to promote greater visibility of the department and opportunities within the department and the rewards of such a career within the Department of Human Services. What I was trying to suggest earlier was that the concern for improving health care and workforce diversity, while seeming they're related, but they aren't the same thing. For example, you can have a diverse workforce that may not be very effective in working with a diverse population.
That's correct.
So we focus on both diverse workforce, as I said, we think is a virtue, but also assuring that all Oregonians have access to health care.
Thank you.
Clearer. I mentioned earlier that the Diversity Development Coordinating Council meets regularly to identify approaches for recruitment and retention. Very expansive group covering many different agencies and programs, works very closely with community-based organizations as well as the private sector to assure that we create additional opportunities for diversifying the workforce. As I mentioned earlier, also, we do a lot of outreach to diverse communities, trying to make opportunities visible, not only at the college level, but also at the high school level, and trying to prime the pump as early as we can. The fourth recommendation from the task force was to meet the needs of underserved communities in Oregon. This included migrant or seasonal farm workers, children of families that are homeless, new immigrants, people served by the juvenile and adult correction system, dependent elderly, and individuals with physical and emotional disabilities. The Office of Multicultural Health and Response has developed training approaches to assure that our workers are more effective, not only with traditional minority populations in Oregon, but also with what are called non-ethnic minority groups, which would be children, homeless, inmates, seniors, and people with disabilities. The Office of Multicultural Health has undergone a change in leadership that should result in more internal support for the department's health services programs. We are working with the various programs within health services to assure that they are more effective and more empowered in working with the diverse communities, and I think that's a strength, that's a new strength that the Office of Multicultural Health is cultivating and developing. The Office of Multicultural Health also has convened community professional collaborative groups to test new outreach methods to deal with issues impacting other underserved populations, including seasonal and migrant farm workers, immigrants and refugees, dependent elderly, incarcerated youth and adults. So again, as we look at underserved Oregonians, we certainly are concerned about the racial and ethnic minorities that face health disparities, but there are other populations that overlap with racial and ethnic groups that we are concerned with as well.
I have a question on minorities that are coming out of incarceration, mm-hmm. and whether or not there is any focus in your area and in your department on assuring that they have the assistance that is needed. For instance, I've been told that some, at least female inmates, when they come out, and I don't know if it applies to all, have to wait as much as 8 or 9 months before the processing goes through for them to receive benefits, and yet the key period for determining, I think, whether or not someone's going to be headed toward recidivism or having a change in their life would be in the first, I would think, 3 months after they're released. And so I'm just wondering if you're involved at all in that one small segment of the population which involves a lot of minorities.
We are, our focus at this point is with the juvenile offenders, quite frankly, because that's where our strengths lie and that's where our resources at this point allow us to go. We certainly work with adult corrections, but not to the extent that we would like to at this point. We're finding right now that we are better equipped to work with OYA, for example, around issues affecting juvenile health, particularly around prevention of such things as sexually transmitted diseases, access alcohol and drug abuse, and things that we think can be prevented early on. Okay. And the last recommendation, which is very brief, was kind of self-serving, perhaps, was to provide funds necessary for the Office of Multicultural Health to conduct the work that it's doing. As Mr. Cass mentioned earlier, one of the areas where we receive funding is through the federal government, and the Office of Multicultural Health will be working to secure more funding outside of, in addition to state funding, federal funding as well.
Any questions from committee? Representative Hannah.
Are we finishing with this section, or
just this one? Oh, one facet. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, before Mr. Mason leaves, I would like to thank you for your good work at the Multicultural Health Office and underscore a very significant point he made earlier with regard to the importance of gathering good health care data, not just out of every community, but out of every composition of that community. It's really and truly a significant and major factor to our addressing the access and quality of health care issues. So I thank you.
I'd like now to bring each of the office administrators up to discuss with you the specific services they provide and the key performance measures that they're responsible for. And let me draw your attention to pages 9 to 14 in the text. That's the sequence we're going to follow. I've also asked each of these administrators to be prepared to discuss with you other data-based measurement that they do within their program areas. Because the key performance measures are limited in number, but the services we deliver are very broad, and we expect to manage everything to an outcome that we're looking to achieve. So I thought you'd like to know some of that as well. The key
moment,
performance measures...
Before we go further, Representative Hannah has a question.
I was trying to determine when the time to do this was, but I want, and as the next few folks come up, maybe it'll be helpful so that they'll be thinking about this kind of question as we go, but... your mission statement includes the reduce the per capita cost of illness for all Oregonians. And so as we're moving forward, given that your information shows 97% of the money we're spending is on personal health care, and that's the expensive side of things, and I think in your testimony that we spend relatively little in prevention, help us as we go through here to see specific steps that are taking to reduce that cost of care. And if you can answer part of that now, that'd be great. But as we're moving forward, help us understand that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I can think of several examples now, but I think you will hear that story told several times in the next 45 minutes with respect, for example, to tobacco, to family planning, to other aspects of the program that we're delivering, where there is a quantifiable outcome, which is a reduced use of personal health care as a result of improved health status. If I understood
that's good. I want to follow up then, because I know we'll see preventative programs and their potential help to that. But can you show us, if we're spending 97% of the dollars on health care costs now, can you tell us what we have been spending and what we might spend looking forward by spending more dollars towards prevention versus direct health care costs? So I want to see how that applies, how that mission applies to how we're actually performing the work. If it's part of our mission, but 97% of our dollars are going the other way, I want you to explain why.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, we'll do our best to do that for you.
Great.
Let me begin then with before we begin, we'll be talking about the key performance measures which are documented in the appendix to the department's overall. This is a very complicated book, and under the tab called Agency Overview, there's a tab called Appendix, and there's a detailed discussion of each key performance measure, and you may want to refer to them as the discussion is proceeding. So first I'm going to ask Dr. Higginson to join us. Dr. Higginson is the State Public Health Officer. We have a number of services organized under his direction.
Good morning, Chair Richardson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and as Mr. Cass said, I'm the State Public Health Officer, and what that has meant for the past couple of years is that my primary responsibility has been as one of the five public health office administrators, and within my office there are four program areas or four program sections. The first one is called Community Liaison, and as Mr. Cass mentioned, our key partner, while we have a variety of partners in the community, our key partner is local health departments. That's where the rubber hits the road. That's where direct public health services are delivered. And community liaison is our primary contact with local health departments. It's not to say that other programs don't have those relationships with program areas and local health departments. In fact, they all do. But community liaison provides the one place where local health departments can come if they have questions or concerns. One of the primary functions that they do is keep some accountability on what's going on at the local level. And so every month we do what's called a triennial review, because over the three-year period we're able to see all 34 local public health authorities. But we do a triennial review to make sure that they are accomplishing the assurances that they are supposed to be accomplishing through our contract that we have with local health departments. And we from that review, come up with a list of areas where they're not in compliance and then make sure that they fall into compliance over the next several months.
There's been a lot of money being transferred from the federal government under health-based clinics, community health clinics, I guess, or community-based clinics. And is that under your purview, or are those clinics, you know, kind of overseen under some other area?
Chair Richardson, they're primarily overseen by another area. However, we do, as I'll talk about in a minute, help to develop some of those clinics, and some of those clinics are run by local health departments, but they are through different funding dollars than come through public health.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Winters. I believe those are in housing and community development. They're under the old, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Grant, State Economic Opportunity, which was the State Economic Opportunity Office, which is Community Action now, and I think that's where the funding stream comes through for those.
Okay, thank you.
And if I might add, Chair Richardson and Senator Winters, a lot of those monies also come through HRSA, the Health Resources Service Administration, and through Medicaid funding as well. The second section that I have in my office is public health preparedness. And again, as Mr. Cass mentioned, over the last 2-3 years, we have been receiving substantial dollars from the federal government to deal with public health preparedness and response to bioterrorism. In my office, one of our key responsibilities in this area is to provide overall coordination and planning for the work we're doing with local health departments, with other parts of the Department of Human Services, and with other local partners. Another area that I'm responsible for in public health preparedness is the communication aspects, and that includes both the technology communications, which we call the Health Alert Network, which connects us electronically to local health departments, hospitals, and other partners, and then also responsible for the personal communication sides, the risk communication sides, if we ever need that. And then another area that I'm responsible for in public health preparedness is the whole system of funding hospitals and health systems entities so that they are also able to respond to bioterrorist attacks, to other public health emergencies, and to other disasters. A third area that I am involved with, and this is actually one of the more controversial ones, although it is not a particularly major public health problem, is our office of our section of special projects, which basically deals with medical marijuana. We are not an advocate or an enforcer of the medical marijuana program. However, it was given to us through the ballot initiative process, and we are responsible for maintaining a registry and making sure that those patients that qualify for a medical marijuana card to get one. And at the current time, we have about 10,000 patients who are on our medical marijuana registration system. And then the fourth and final area of responsibility for me is our health systems planning section. And this section basically has two major areas of focus. One of them is patient safety. As Mr. Cass mentioned, this office was part of a coalition that last session helped to get a bill passed through the legislature that created the Oregon Patient Safety Commission, and we've been involved over the last year and a half or so of getting that commission up and functioning. That, I think, has been really a tremendous cooperative, collaborative effort between the industry, professional organizations, consumers, and the department, and it is one area where Representative Hannah was asking about where we may see cost savings. If we can really promote a culture of patient safety and reduce the number of medical errors that we're seeing in hospitals and other healthcare facilities, that is an area where we can see cost savings. Another part of patient safety is we are responsible for a certificate of need program and a plans review program. So those two programs, again, have something to do with cost containment and safety, making sure that in some instances where we have the authority that we're only building or expanding facilities where those facility services are truly needed, and then the plans review process to make sure that anything that is being built is being built safely. And then the second part of health systems planning is the whole area of access to health care. And there we do a number of things. We try to make sure that there are increasing numbers of health care providers in those areas where there are not enough health care providers currently available. We do that through a number of ways. One is working directly with migrant and seasonal health care issues, and another one is dealing with trying to increase the number of safety net clinics. And just here's a little example, a story that is included in the information that you received on page 11, and that is that in Wasco County in 2002, an assessment was done showing that there were 15,000 migrants living and working there that did not have access to health care. And so consequently, our office, working with the local health department, with community leaders, and with a private nonprofit organization, were able to get a clinic funded there through federal dollars that now serves those patients. And again, I think that this is a another place where we can see cost savings, because if those patients, when they have health care needs, are not seen early in primary health care services, they're going to use emergency rooms and other much more expensive services. And then I was also asked just to very briefly talk about the performance measure that I have responsibility for, and that is performance measure number 27, which is the percentage of uninsured Oregons served by safety net clinics.
The next tab in your book is the performance measures for this, for public health. So if you just turn to page 9 in the next tab, you'll see KPM 27. That's the one that Grant is going to talk about now.
And as I mentioned, it's the percentage of uninsured Oregon served by safety net clinics. And unfortunately, this is not a performance measure that we have been able to meet. In fact, we are not doing as well with the percentage of Oregonians served by safety net clinics as we have in the past. However, that's not to say that we have not been making progress. And in fact, when you look at the absolute number of patients served in safety net clinics, that has increased. The problem that we've seen over the last several years is because of the hard-hit economy that we've seen, more people unemployed, the cuts that have had to be made to the Oregon Health Plan, we simply have more people who are uninsured or underinsured, and consequently, even though we've been increasing the number of patients served in safety net clinics, we simply have not been able to keep up with the percentage. And that was the end of my remarks, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you. Questions? Looks like none at this time.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, our next administrator is Gail Shibley. Gail used to be on that side of the table as a legislator during the 90s. Gail now runs the Office of Public Health Systems. This is an environmental health program primarily, but also does a good deal of licensing for health care. The key performance measures do not include any specific measures that are based in this particular office, but Gail Shibley has also established her own set of performance measures for her office, and she'll describe that for you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a delight to be here. For the record, my name is Gail Shibley. I am the administrator of the Office of Public Health Systems for the Department of Human Services. As Mr. Cass mentioned, the 28 key performance measures for DHS do not touch on the specific activities within the Office of Public Health Systems. We are kind of the quality assurance office, if you will, of public health, so that when you turn on the tap in the morning to brush your teeth, you can be sure that water is safe to drink. When you call 911, there's a whole system back there from the point of injury or trauma all the way up through hospital stay. When you take your elderly parent to the hospital, you can make sure that they don't get sick inside the hospital, but instead have an opportunity to get well. When you go out and grab a bite to eat from a restaurant or from a dining trailer outside, you can make sure that you can be sure that food is safe and sound for you to eat. When you want to, you may be familiar with the show This Old House. We have a lot of this old houses in the state of Oregon. Most of them have paint that was that contains high amounts of lead, and we do an awful lot of work to make sure that when you remodel your old house, you do so in a way that is safe both for you and for the people around you. And as Mr. Cass mentioned earlier as well, when you have your dental appointment and you get all your bite wing x-rays, that both the machine and the operator are finely tuned and provide the information that you need and is not unsafe for anybody around it. We do these kinds of things really by focusing on three business strategies for three outcomes. The strategies really include licensing and certification, technical assistance, consultation, information, education, and training, and investigation and enforcement as appropriate. The outcomes we're really looking for are right in line with the outcomes identified already, which is 1, prevent injury and illness; 2, ensure high-quality health care, and three, help people understand what their health risks are. And again, through all of that, we are looking at customer satisfaction and regulatory streamlining, really making making sure that what we do makes sense for the outcomes that that we're trying to achieve. The six sections within the Office of Public Health Systems are rather diverse in and of themselves. However, they do all encompass the outcomes and the strategies that I mentioned. One, the drinking water program. Secondly, emergency medical services and the trauma systems for the state of Oregon. Three, environmental toxicology. Four, health and safety for food, pools, and lodging, hospitality end of kind of cluster of industries in our state. Five, licensing and certifying acute care facilities, all non-long-term care facilities, and five, radiation protection services. I believe there may have been available for handing out some specific information related to just a couple of the activities within this very diverse office, each of which have received a great deal of attention and concern.
We haven't seen those.
Okay. These are just two. Yes, I'll put them right here. There are 50 copies for your time.
We'll get them to
them. Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Oh. Thank you. There has been a great deal of attention and awareness, for example, on lead-based paint. And one of the handouts that I believe Mr. Cass is making available to you is just a snapshot of select counties in Oregon, not all 36 of them, but just, happenstance. I think they may be of interest to the folks here to give you a snapshot of the percentage of housing units with interior lead-based paint and the number of... And then that percentage translated into the raw number, as it were, the number of housing units. These numbers, it should be noted, are based on construction data. That is, all housing units, residential housing, of course, residential housing units built prior to 1950. It wasn't until 1978 that the Consumer Product Safety Commission banned lead-containing paint for residential purposes. However, over the years and decades prior to that, internationally, particularly health concerns related to lead-containing paint became more and more well-known. Other countries were banning it, and in response or in concert with that, the industry was reducing the amount, so that by 1978, 75% of, I believe, latex-based and 90% of oil-based paints had small amounts of lead. But and so we use a more conservative, for this purpose here, we use a more conservative figure of 1950 to just to demonstrate to you where this housing unit is in the state.
Okay. Gail, the thing that I just handed out says Oregon Drug Labs reported and decontaminated. Is there a lead paint one? Okay.
But this was very interesting.
Well, that's the one I'm about to get to, so you're just a little ahead of me.
While they're passing that out, would you mind addressing we all know that we've all heard how bad lead-based paint is. I'm wondering how big of a problem is it? Do you have any idea how many cases have been reported in the last 12 months in Oregon of children ingesting lead-based paint and the consequences of that?
Mr. Chair, it's a terrific question, which I could answer, and I would ask my colleague, the state epidemiologist, Dr. Mel Cohen, when he comes up here to verify this number. But in Oregon, actually, the elevated blood lead levels are lower than in some other states in the industrial east, for example. Around 1 to 2% of children have been identified as having elevated blood lead levels. Lead-based paint is the single biggest contributing factor to the elevated blood lead levels in children.
just one point, Mr. Chair, is that this is one of those areas of health disparities that Mr. Mason was talking about, because many of these homes are older homes. They are house more people of color, so that the prevalence of high blood levels in African-American children is substantially higher than for the population as a whole. That's the kind of thing we're talking about in terms of addressing health disparities.
Yeah,
so we should be informed.
What I'm getting at is if this has been going on for three decades, how big of a problem is it still? I mean, you know, we no longer spend a tremendous amount of money fighting polio, because polio no longer is a big issue, although it could be, and it's certainly a dramatic thing. And so I'm wondering about lead-based paint, whether it is continuing to be a huge issue, or over time, because of the fact that people do paint and they do, you know, cover things up, whether it's still an issue as big as it was before, and we can get to that a little bit later too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The pieces of this effort that my office is responsible for is related to licensing, training, and enforcement. We actually applied for a federal grant.
They're not happy with what you're saying, and so I'm sorry.
We'd actually much rather listen to you, Gail, but we have to go listen to Peter Courtney preside from the dais of the Senate chamber.
Well, I'll excuse you then, Senator Westland.
If you could give me a note, I'd happily take it later.
I'll bet he would appreciate that too.
Not 11:30.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I may continue. The other, as it turns out, that the first handout which you were provided also shows the prevalence of Oregon drug labs that have been reported to us by law enforcement and decontaminated. Clandestine drug lab cleanup actually began in Oregon in 1990, the first state in the country, and I wish I could say we'd worked ourselves out of business. Unfortunately, that is not the case, and in fact, part of the reason why methamphetamine use and the dangers associated with the laboratories has gotten more and more attention is because, in fact, it has spread and continues to spread to this day. I believe in 1990, our first year of gathering data, we had something like 24 laboratories that were busted and were on our list. Last year we had 324, and it just continues to stay about that level. Some years are bumping up, other years are bumping down, but you'll see that we have in the aggregate about 73% of the laboratories that have been identified to us declared unfit for use according to the Oregon revised statutes, have been cleaned up per the performance measures that my office is responsible for overseeing. I really just wanted to provide that as a point of information for you, for your constituents. There's a note on the bottom, actually, of both each of these pages. But in terms of the drug lab sheet at the bottom, the building codes division provides a listing on the web of current up-to-date properties. Actually, the addresses of the properties are listed. It's a matter of public information, and so we provide that website for you just for your information. I believe we're going to be getting to this in the next phase, but I just want to mention in terms of the some of the pie charts that you've seen already this morning, the approximately $23 million or so that the Office of Public Health Systems is responsible for, about 6 to 7% of that is general fund, about 73% of that is federal funds, and about 20% of that is other funds or fee revenue. That federal fund figure includes the state revolving fund, which provides dollars matched by the state to provide local communities dollars to build capital improvements to their drinking water and wastewater facilities. It has loaned just over $100 million to about 40-some communities over the years that it's been in existence, a tremendous assistance to communities all over the state. Last but not least, I mentioned at the beginning regulatory streamlining and spinning off state programs. The food program I'll mention as a particular point, although Senator Winters has had to depart. It's something that's been near and dear to her heart, I know. With our partners at the counties, and thanks to the passage of last session's House Bill 3156, the state of Oregon is getting out of the business of directly enforcing, going into individual restaurants and inspecting restaurant kitchens and food preparation and so on. And instead are working very, very closely with the smaller counties where we have been the direct service providers to build that capacity at the local level. So it is locally directed and locally provided, and our responsibility continues to be a very important one of standardization of training, best practices, data collection, consultation, facilitation, technical assistance. That, in a nutshell, is I believe really the nut of what we do, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Has there been a reduction in resources needed in your budget with the transfer of some of these responsibilities for inspection actually to the counties?
Mr. Chair, yes. Although we continue to need dollars for the services we do provide, but certainly for those services which we no longer provide, we no longer get those dollars.
Okay. Representative Hanna.
Well, thank you. Several of you have mentioned safe drinking water, and you know, we're talking about prevention of health care. Will we hear from any of you at some point about additives to safe drinking water in any way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, would you be referring to something called fluoride?
Potentially.
I see. Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I really don't ask that too tongue-in-cheek. The reason is because of the way things have been organized within public health in the state overall. It's not something that for which my office is in the proverbial driver's seat, but rather the Office of Family Health in terms of oral health care. Within my office, drinking water protection, we make sure that whatever is added to the water is done so safely per the EPA federal regulations and guidelines.
As a follow-up, your office would be responsible to implement that policy decision, would it not, as far as inspections, making sure that, you know, that it's all done in a safe manner?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. What we would do is collect test data from the 2,734 community water systems in the state, or whatever slice of those that this body determines is appropriate for whatever additive it might be. And so we would collect that. We would consult with the individual water operators and ensure that both the quality and the process meet federal health standards.
Well, since this is such a hotly debated issue in the legislature now, I'm sure that you have done some anticipatory planning if there was to be implemented statewide fluoridation requirements. What kind of money would be required to be added to your budget to help implement that, the inspections and so forth?
Mr. Chair, honestly, we don't foresee a tremendous increment of additional resources needed within, again, my part of this effort. It would be one of frankly, dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of of additives or contaminants, chemicals, if you will, that we ensure are within specific regulated standards.
So as far as your department is concerned, it would just be an additional one on the list. It wouldn't
exactly.
be a whole new process.
That's exactly right.
Representative Hanna.
I'd like to follow up on that. Is your office responsible for the $100 million that's been loaned out to municipalities for improvements to their water systems?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, what happens is that the dollars come from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to this office. We then, through an agreement with the Oregon Department of Economic Development, provide those dollars to them along with categorization of priorities based on health risks for the applications that they have into them, and then that department oversees the granting and administration of those loan funds.
So then, based on that, do you know if there's an estimate for the additional dollars needed for municipalities if there were to be a program implemented in terms of what additional resources would it take to implement that and over what time period?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, if what you're talking about is fluoride and if what you're talking about is House Bill 2025, I believe that refers only to public water systems with 10,000 or more connections. And of those that do not fluoridate now, I don't know how many, off the top of my head, how many additional systems that would be or if it would take capital construction to enable those local water systems to implement that policy. The State Revolving Fund is for capital construction only.
Okay, let's move on.
Mr. Chairman, the Representative Jensen's committee has actually explored that question, and that those estimates are available if you would like us to
Well, we can check with them ourselves. Thank you.
I just wanted to point out there is a slide in your package, number 11, which demonstrates, I think, improvement in waterborne disease outbreaks. Our problem in drinking water is that we are not meeting all of the expectations. We were the subject of a Secretary of State audit 3 or 4 years ago. When we come back in March, there will be some discussion of the budgetary implications of the governor's proposals for drinking water, and we'll bring all that back in quantify that for you at that time.
Okay, thank you. Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gail, did you have any numbers in terms of what the cost of the lab cleanups either has been or on the ones that are pending, what it will cost? I just kind of general information. The other question is, how is it paid for? Can landlords make claims on insurance companies? Is there any help? Just kind of the general picture of how this activity is paid for.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, many good questions embedded in there. And the bottom line is that the responsibility belongs to the property owner. There are a few options available to the property owner. One is demolition of the property. Another is full disclosure sale. Another is cleanup. With kind of an additional wrinkle, if you will, to that, which provides for some owner-assisted work related to that. However, all of them do require direct oversight of trained, certified cleanup contractors. The individual costs are literally all over the map, depending on whether or not it may be a motel room or a storage locker or a 72 Buick that I just signed a certificate of fitness on, or somebody's barn, et cetera, et cetera. It just really depends on the extent and the breadth and the depth of the contamination, and that can only be determined on a site-specific sampling and testing. But it is several thousands of dollars. There's no question.
Okay. We'll need to actually adjourn at about 28 after, since we have a floor session at 10:30.
Then, Mr. Chairman, we'll have room for one more administrator today. We'll have to come back tomorrow morning and conclude public health. I'm going to ask Mel Cohn, our epidemiologist, to discuss his four key performance measures in the program that he operates.
Welcome. Actually, it's timely for you to be here. You can follow up on some of those other questions as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist in the department. I'm actually trained and boarded as a pediatrician, but I've been working in public health for about 10 years. Epidemiology is the study of the distribution and determinants of disease and injury. And we use what we find out from those kinds of studies to try to design effective prevention programs. So we're very, my shop in particular is quite data heavy, if you will. What Gail said earlier with regard to lead poisoning is absolutely true. We are at about 1 to 2% of children overall, we believe, have elevated blood lead levels. But, you know, not all elevations are the same. 20 or 30 years ago, we were seeing very high elevations of lead. That was not that uncommon. That could really be life-threatening. Now the elevations that we're seeing, not only are they fewer in number, but the amount of elevation is lower as well. We do know that that has serious health consequences, particularly around cognitive abilities for those children, and it is something that continues to be of concern. But I think we've made a great deal of progress in terms of bringing down the lead levels. This is something that's happened not only in Oregon, but nationally as well.
Thank you.
Okay. Second here. What I'd like to do briefly is go through several of the major areas that my office covers, give you a little bit of a flavor for what we do in those different areas, and then dive into the key performance measures related to my office as well. So the first area I'd like to talk about is communicable disease control, and right now I'm on pages 12 and 13. Of the public health overview. We work with our partners at the local level to investigate disease outbreaks. We also work with the healthcare system to work with them around disease outbreaks and communicable diseases that do occur. Page 13 is one example of an outbreak that we did investigate. This was an outbreak of a disease caused by a bacteria called E. coli 0157. You've probably heard of it. It's been a serious problem here in the Northwest for quite some time. This was an outbreak that unfolded fairly rapidly, and as we got into it, discovered that the one thing that people had in common, that the kids with this illness had in common, was having been to the Lane County Fair. When we did further interviews with them and their families, we were able to narrow down that it was one particular area of the fair that they all had visited, the area that had sheep and goats there. Now, this was a serious disease. I mean, we had 79 cases, including 22 hospitalizations, 12 with very severe kidney complications. This can be a life-threatening illness. You know, the way that this disease is typically transmitted is either through eating contaminated food or somehow swallowing some of this bacteria so that it gets into your body and then multiplies. We weren't able to pin down exactly what happened in that goat and sheep barn, although we were able to recover bacteria with the very same molecular fingerprint from the barn there. So we know that it was there, and we're quite sure that that's where it happened. With children, typically what happens is they'll touch something, put their hands in their mouth, and this is a very common way for them to get sick. And so hand washing can be a very, very effective way. Seems like a very simple and obvious thing, but can be a very, very effective way to prevent this kind of illness. So we worked with the fair and were able to greatly increase the level of hand washing that occurred.
The graph. I mean, some things, the graphs indicate ongoing long-term problems. What you're discussing are outbreaks. And so it seems like it's almost every year you would have a new set of data based on the outbreaks of that year. You wouldn't have the same barn and the same problem in a subsequent year. And yet the graph indicates an ongoing trend. And so can you give us some ideas? Is there a trend of renewing, increasing number of outbreaks each year?
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely right that the kinds of outbreaks, the different bacteria that are involved change and evolve so that they do change from year to year. What you see in the graph is an increasing number of outbreaks that we've been able to detect. And I think that's largely due to two different forces at play here. One is we have, since 2001, really been able to expand with the help of some of the bioterrorism detection funding that was mentioned by Dr. Higginson earlier, to expand the capacity of our local health departments to detect outbreaks. It's sort of like if you put more cops on the street, you will have more arrests, regardless of the level of crime, if you will. And so I think that's what happened, is that our detection has largely improved. In addition, we are seeing some new things that are difficult to control, one in particular, norovirus or Norwalk viruses. This is a very common cause of vomiting and diarrhea. And you may know of it sort of as the cruise ship outbreak pathogen that's been involved with that. We are seeing a lot of those outbreaks. They're extraordinarily difficult to control because this is a very, very contagious kind of pathogen. Fortunately, it's typically not life-threatening. It's something that most people get better from, but it's not only extremely unpleasant, but it can be life-threatening in people who are otherwise compromised for other reasons. Okay, you had asked a little while ago about, Mr. Chair, about how we compare to other states, and I wanted to mention two recent things that are not specifically in your book, but I happen to be reading. This is a publication that comes from the Federal Centers for Disease Control. It's published every week. It's called the MMWR, or the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, and it has kind of dispatches from health departments around the country. And there's one in here from Oregon regarding a pertussis outbreak. Pertussis is also known as whooping cough, that occurred in a major hospital here in Oregon and that we were involved in investigating. I think the fact that this got published the way that it did indicates the quality of work that we're doing, and I think that our colleagues are looking to learn from the sorts of things that we're doing. In addition, last May, we investigated an outbreak of salmonellosis. This is another foodborne bacterium that we investigated really in extremely rapid time. We first learned about this outbreak by looking at the molecular fingerprints of some isolates of salmonella that some healthcare providers had sent in to us. And we found two or three of them that matched up, and that was quite unusual. When we looked a little further, we found that over the last few months there had actually been five. So we got on the phone, started talking with these folks, and we were able to very rapidly identify that almonds that they had purchased at Costco were the thing that these folks had in common. We then got on the phone. This all happened within an afternoon. We were able to track this down. We got on the phone with the folks from Costco. They were, of course, very concerned about this, although the problem was probably upstream. They just happened to be the major distributor where this was first detected. And as this evolved, it turned out that this was probably an outbreak that had been going on for several years but had eluded detection by most other health departments around the country. So this has resulted in some major changes in the way that almonds are processed. I think it's a lot safer situation now for consumers. And again, just to illustrate, I think we do a lot of very good work that other health departments look to what we're doing in this area. The next area I want to briefly talk about is chronic disease prevention, and we have a variety of areas that we work in under the chronic disease rubric. As the population ages, of course, chronic diseases become more and more of a burden for us, and the area I want to talk about is diabetes. The death rate from diabetes has been increasing since 1988, and was the seventh leading cause of death in 2002, with over 1,000 people who died from complications of diabetes. Now, we know that keeping careful control of your blood sugar and getting good preventive care really improves outcome and reduces the costs to the healthcare system ultimately of taking care of those outcomes. And so we've been working with a variety of folks in the healthcare community to improve preventive care. We've developed in a collaborative way some guidelines that they can use to the health systems can use to try to improve the way that preventive care is delivered to folks with diabetes in the community. We also work with a large number of community groups because you know, what really keeps people with diabetes healthy, as important as what happens in the doctor's office is, what really keeps them healthy is what they're doing every day, what kind of self-management they're doing. And so working with community groups to try to promote self-management, appropriate self-management in a variety of ways is something that we're doing. Injury prevention, moving on to the next area, suicide prevention.
Yes, we have about 4 minutes. I do want you to get to the key performance.
Okay. Okay. Well, I will come back to these at another time if time allows, but let's move on to the performance measures then.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Okay, now I'm on the performance measures section. We have several here, including the first of which is the youth suicide rate. We have a small program. We have a youth suicide prevention coordinator who's been working in a variety of ways to collaborate with our partners both in and out of the department, and obviously the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services is a very important partner in that regard. Several years ago, we put together a group that wrote a state plan to take action on this. We are tracking the rates of youth suicide in the state, and the rates have actually been dropping, perhaps not as dramatically as we would have liked. This is an area that is receiving a great deal of attention, and we are expecting and hoping that we will be able to get some additional federal resources for this through the work of Senator Smith, who's been very involved in this area.
When you say that they're dropping, how does that compare with the rates in other states and nationally?
They are dropping across the country as well.
So we don't know actually if what we're doing is making any difference at all, or if it's just kind of a national phenomenon?
I think the rates are dropping faster here in Oregon than they are nationally, but it's not a dramatic difference. Again, this is a fairly small program. We have essentially one staff person who works on this, and we're working through a wide variety of partners.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to page 4 of the performance measures, we'll talk a little bit about tobacco. This is in our chronic disease program. Tobacco remains the leading preventable cause of death and disability in Oregon, as it does across the country. 18 Oregonians a day die from the effects of tobacco use. We have shown some fairly dramatic declines since our tobacco prevention and education program began in 1997. This is a program that's supported largely through ballot measure 44 funds. It was a cigarette tax that was voted in 1996. The rate of decline in per capita cigarette consumption in Oregon is about twice what has been seen nationally. We believe that difference is largely due to the effects of our program, and perhaps at a later time we'll have an opportunity to talk some more about the components of that program and why we feel that that's effective. We do have, I think, very good data around tobacco showing that our program is having a fairly dramatic effect. We're very concerned about tobacco use among youth and among pregnant women, both of whom are very vulnerable populations in this regard. And then finally, on page 8, the last performance measure that my office is involved in, the annual rate of HIV infection per 100,000 persons. Oregon is a low-incidence state for HIV compared to our neighbors and compared to the national rates. Our rates are substantially lower. In addition, the population groups that are affected by this epidemic have largely been unchanged here in Oregon compared to other places where the epidemic has hit very hard. I think in part that's due to the work not only that we're doing but that many of our community partners are doing. Incidentally, some of you may have heard there was a rather ominous development in the HIV scene about a case of a highly drug-resistant strain of HIV that was detected in New York City. This was announced last week. This is not only a very deadly strain, progresses to AIDS and death very rapidly, but also this is a very concerning development because the drugs that we have don't work very well for it. So that is something we're tracking very closely as well.
This is extremely fascinating, and I hope that we can spend more time with it, but we do need to adjourn for the day. Thank you so much, and we look forward to continuing tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr.
We're adjourned.
Thank you.